Hello, welcome to Series 6, Episode 4 of the Prompted by Nature podcast. I'm Helen, your host, and today I am thrilled to release a conversation I had earlier this week with the completely wonderful Marshelle Farrell. Long-time listeners of the podcast might remember Marshelle from Series 2, Episode 10, a conversation we recorded in what feels like a lifetime ago in November 2020, and it feels like a lot has happened since then. In the interim, Marshelle has written a book, which is out now, called Uprooting, and it was so wonderful to chat with her and to talk all things gardens and writing. So in this episode, we discuss what Marshelle's been up to for the past 2 years, her new book, Uprooting, what it's about and how it came to be, the reciprocal nature of the garden, redefining difficult conversations, the importance of grief and mourning, non-verbal communication and writing, the creative advice she'd give her younger self and what she's looking forward to, along with a whole host of other things. This was such a deep, profound, wonderful conversation. And Marshelle just always gives some of the deepest insights. I think, I don't know if it's her background in psychiatry, but she's such a brilliant speaker. And I was really grateful to go and see her actually at the Brighton Book Festival a couple of months ago. She came down here to talk on a panel with a couple of other writers, and it was so wonderful seeing her in her element, in her flow, doing her thing and talking about the book and all of the issues that were raised in that conversation. Uprooting has already won an award in the shape of the Nan Shepherd Prize for Underrepresented Voices in Nature Writing. And I really do urge you to read this book. It's profound, complex, and it explores Marshelle's relationship with her garden, as well as how this relationship brings up connections to her beloved Trinidad. Uprooting is out now in your local bookshop or library. And remember, you can always ask them to order it in if they don't already have it in stock. Marshelle is usually to be found on Instagram under the handle @afroliage and on her website www.marshellefarrell.com, where you can find upcoming dates of her book tour and speaking events. I would also recommend getting signed up to her Substack newsletter because it's beautiful. That was how I first came across her on Instagram, and then that was how I first connected with her writing, was through her Substack newsletter. It's called These Are the Things My Garden Taught Me. I'll put a link in the show notes. And it's really wonderful. And it's not one of these, she doesn't put it out every week. They're sort of, there's like a longer gap between each one. But every single one is always just beautiful. So yes, a very high recommend for that one. So before we get into the conversation, just a little note that the connection was a little bit sketchy at times. The weather down here in Brighton has been so bad, and it always affects the connection. I don't think it affects the actual conversation and any of the meanings. And it's only a couple of times, but just a little heads up, but that does happen. So episodes that would go well with this one, of course, Series 2, Episode 10A, My Garden, My Teacher, with Marshelle Farrell, because it would be really lovely to go and listen to that one first and then see how things have developed, how the conversation has developed. Series 5, Episode 9A, Writing in Place, with Catherine Alto, and then Series 6, Episode 1A, All My Wild Mothers, Victoria Bennett. As always, I'm on Instagram @prompted.by.nature or on the website www.promptedbynature.co.uk. And you can also sign up for my own Substack on promptedbynature.substack.com. But all of the links to those are on my website. So if you just go there, everything is there. I'm taking a little bit of a summer break from the newsletter just because I'm juggling childcare and Parents for Future bits and this. So yeah, I'm trying to give myself a little bit of space. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Let me know your thoughts. If you want to reach out to me, I always love hearing from you. In the meantime, I am sending you lots of love, happy listening, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye. Love to hear kind of how things have been and what you've been up to in the past couple of years since we last spoke.
So I mean, I've spent a lot of the last 2 years writing.
Yeah.
Basically feeling very, I think, so when I spoke to you, I must have been in the process of developing the proposal for the book, but still not really believing that it could truly that it was that any of it was real. And I think I've spent a long time not believing that any of this was real. I think it just about has started to feel real today, now that like friends are messaging me the book arriving on their doorsteps and downloading into their Kindles and all this sort of a thing. And I'm like, oh, it's out in the world. It's a real thing. And I finally understand actually why there's often a comparison between writing a book and giving birth, because it reminds me of the feeling when I had my son, when I met him, that like, I knew I was having a baby, obviously, on a conscious, on a sort of cognitive, logical level, I knew I was having a baby. And yet, I just remember this intense feeling of surprise when I met him.
Yeah.
You're like, it's
It's
you.
you, I know.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's an actual person. You're a real person. Oh my goodness. So it feels very similar to that. Like, oh my God, it's you. There's this book, your hair. I mean, I wrote you, and yet somehow you're this thing that's very kind of, you're your own thing that's separate from you. It's going to go and have its own life now, and it's going to meet other readers' minds, and that's entirely separate from me, you know, how other people read it and receive it. It's got its own life now, and that feels amazing, but also quite parallel to that kind of feeling that I had when I gave birth, which is really odd. So I've spent 2 years kind of gestating and writing, and then late the labor of actually getting the book, you know, having it become a physical thing, which really was more labor than I anticipated, you know, all of the like editing and copy editing and all that kind of process of the book taking form, you know, and a real sense of how much it takes a village for all of that to happen. You know, it's not a process that happens in isolation at all. There's so many people who are vital to the book becoming a real. Yeah, so I've been doing that. I've been somehow also still trying to be a mother and raise a family. And I've still had my fingers in too many pies in the village, in the community that I live in, although I have had to drop a few over the last year in particular, because it was all kind of getting just a little bit too much. But still deeply involved in my kids' school. That's the one club that I've really stayed very linked in, because it feels like a natural home for me, I suppose. Because that again feels like one of these processes that takes a village. Like I hand my kids over to the teachers at the start of the school day, but actually they need our support as well as parents to, you know, if I'm going to hope that my kids have the kind of education that I would love them to have, and that I know that personally at this phase in my life, I dream of homeschooling them, but I also know that it would be the end of me if I tried to do that myself. So I've stayed very involved with the school. Like this, I run the school gardening club, I'm on the PTA. I just try and support the teachers and the staff team in any way that I kind of practically can, and always with a thing of trying to bring this ethos of deepening a connection to nature, or kind of remembering our place in nature. So the gardening club is really sweet. I've been co-opted onto the village horticultural society for my sins, and they very generously support the school gardening club, because that's one of the things that they want to do, is to increase their links with like the younger people in the village, because the village hortsoc is an older demographic. And you know, sometimes in the kind of when I have to like feed back on what we've done, and I feel like there's this sort of traditional thing of like, well, what have the children learned to grow, and what sort
Yeah, oh
of
goodness.
have you had?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it's all a little bit more ad hoc if you're looking at the outcome from that kind of perspective. But actually, if we're thinking about children just having a space where they can feel more comfortable in nature, and because I'm still always so struck by how, even though this is a countryside village, there's so many kids who have never touched a caterpillar, never seen, you know, a particular kind of moth or butterfly, you know, still just like totally fascinated by worms, you know, eating vegetables for the first time, like raw off the plant, you know, and that fills me with joy, and that feels like the thing that the club is really about, more than teaching them any kind of gardening skills, because goodness knows I'm not a formally trained gardener. I don't have that many, but I do have a sense, I think, of how to connect and how to form a relationship. So that's what it's all about. So I've still been doing a lot of that stuff. So it's felt busy, but worthwhile.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking, you know, you talk about the gardening club and, you know, it's almost hard to quantify or qualify even what is being learned. But I've always thought, you know, having taught and all of that sort of stuff, I've always thought it's the extracurricular clubs where you can be more like expansive in that way, I suppose, because you're not so driven by objectives and targets. And I think it's so, like you say, about being more involved in your children's school, it's so crucial. I think parents underestimate how important that sort of stuff is. Not all parents, obviously, a lot understand, but I love that you're running a gardening club, and I love that you're passing this on, because that is like what, and also it's that thing of like, why should we have to say what skill they've learned today or what target they've hit today? Why should we have to do that? Like, isn't it enough just to give them the experience of being outside with their hands in the soil and getting mucky and, you know?
Yes, I agree. I agree so much. You know, it's these this idea of productivity, isn't it? And really just wanting to subvert that at every possible chance. I agree. Yeah, and like even with the PTA and our fundraising, the thing that we've been fundraising for over the last 2 years has been to rejuvenate the kids' outdoor play space. Because again, even though it's a village school, their main play area has been a kind of paved playground, and they do have a bit that they call an adventure playground, but it's been, you know, it's been the old play equipment that was in there has been rotting. It's become more and more unsafe. It's not accessible to kids who have any kind of mobility needs. So we have just about raised enough money to break ground later this year on renovating that space. A, to make it more accessible to all children, and then B, to bring more planting in, and to plant it in a way that again encourages that being in the space and exploring of what's in there. So, you know, the hope is to add a lot of sensory plants, things that are really interesting to touch or to smell or to, you know, to just interact with in wonderful ways.
That sounds amazing. I mean, congratulations on that. You know, because do it like having any kind of involvement with the school is enough for many people, but you've written a book of the process. And I was going to ask you about your garden, but I think we'll wait to discuss, because I feel like we could go down a rabbit hole with our gardens, because I've just started growing veg in mine, and the slugs, after all of this rain, have gone a bit nuts. But we'll put that aside for a minute. So the book, can you give a brief synopsis of the book, and then maybe how it came about, the process of actually, I mean, you've kind of alluded to the process of writing it, but yeah, a little bit of a synopsis, and then and kind of how it came about as well.
It always feels a bit much to try and summarize the book, because I pack in so many themes, and I hope I've done it well. People have said wonderful things about how.
Honestly, Marshall, yeah, we can I have so many questions about this book, because not questions, but like almost like you did this really well and you did this really well and that was brilliant. That was brilliant, because it is the way that you weave it all in is
Oh,
just, it's so complex. So, but
thank you.
any kind of if you can put something complex into.
Yeah, so I've tried to keep this. So the structure of the book is really simple. It's a year in my garden, and we pretty much never leave the garden in terms of like present chronological time in the story. And it begins just when we've moved in, and it ends 1 year later. So it's the first day of meeting this garden, establishing a relationship with it. And that happens in the time of the pandemic. So I think often when we move somewhere new, we tend to focus on human relationships. We tend to focus on the community, the kind of human community that we sort of meet and begin to build. But because of that particular time, kind of moving in, and then a couple of months later, I think on relationship with place, on the relationship with this place that I was in a very intimate and quite intense kind of way. And so the book goes through the year. Each chapter is a flower, something that comes into flower in our garden in that month. And each chapter then becomes a reflection on the kind of themes that flower represents for me. Themes in terms of the present time of what I'm kind of going through as I develop a relationship with this English garden, being a sort of Trinidadian who emigrated here and has been trying to navigate the idea of making a home and finding belonging in England as a Black immigrant, which is a fraught thing to do. So kind of the present day of sort of navigating that, but also the themes that the flowers kind of trigger in memory. So in the memory of the gardens that I grew up in Trinidad, as well as, many years past, sort of the historical Trinidad also gets woven into the book. And I try to bring together the things that link all of those, because they may not, well, I suppose it depends on how you've come to gardening and how you think about gardens, but certainly I feel that for most people they may not seem obviously linked. But I suppose the thing that felt very powerful for me was that they're profoundly linked, actually. And that those links are sometimes really painful, but also, they're very powerful. And there's something that's potentially really kind of loving in them if you kind of explore them deeply. So that's what I try to do, really. Try to navigate and look at and understand the links between the home that I made in Trinidad and this home that I kind of felt drawn to in England, and make sense of them.
And how did the book sort of emerge? Because I remember last time we spoke, you have, I mean, you still have your wonderful newsletter, the Things a Garden Taught Me. And how did that sort of create lay the foundations, I suppose, for the book?
So when I first started, I mean, really what happened was I got signed by my agent. And that whole process was incredibly organic. So I started writing the newsletter, and another published author, Rebecca Schiller, who is amazing and so supportive and just an incredible human being, got in touch saying how much she loved my writing and asked if she could share one of my pieces on her own kind of newsletter, to kind of, uplift it and give it more, put, get more eyes on it, because at that point my newsletter was very, very new. And she also raved about me to her agent, who is now my agent.
Yay.
And really, I had very little self-belief, I suppose, when I first started writing this, that I could write a book, that I had the wherewithal to write a book. But really, through conversations with Rebecca and with Julia, and then I started having some writing mentoring as well. Initially, I was like, I just want to write like a series of essays, a bit like my newsletter, but a series of essays that explore these kind of interlinked themes. But the more I wrote, the more it became apparent that actually there was one particular narrative that really needed to be told. And that it was my story, even though I was kind of avoiding the idea of, I mean, I was always writing memoir. I think that I was avoiding the idea of writing memoir. But it became really apparent that it was that it that that this particular story needed to be told. And I think it really came out of the very first story that I wrote. Like, all the themes are there about my grandmother and growing up in her garden and the things that she loved about gardening that were now in my garden. And the things that felt fraught and painful about that, but that also felt loving and wonderful about those connections. You know, they were kind of all there in that very first story. So the book really grew out of that. And I often think about it as a co-creation with the garden, because actually it was so inspired by the things that were growing and that I was discovering and that were coming into flower, and then the epiphanies and links and thoughts that they were then growing in my mind, and that kind of interrelationship, you know, between the things that the garden was showing me and the things that I was then thinking, and then the work I would then do in the garden as a result of that, you know, this kind of real back and forth. So it feels as though, I mean, I might have written a book had I landed in any other garden. And actually, it's really interesting. I sort of, in writing this book, I reflected on the fact that every time I have written creatively in any kind of serious way has been when I've lived in a place with a garden. Before they were rented, and we never had our own garden in the UK before. But yeah, so I found that discovery, that realization, very interesting. But I don't think I would have written this particular book in any other garden. It's so shaped by being in this very specific place. So it does feel as though the weeds kind of grew out of the garden and into me.
There is a real sense of that. And one of the things that I was gonna not necessarily ask, but sort of, well, I suppose ask is, there is a real sense, and you kind of allude to it throughout the book, this sense of your garden as being as grateful for you as you are of it. There's this constant, it's not just your appreciation of the garden, it's the garden. You know, you sort of talk about this fact that the garden is welcoming you and the garden is relieved that you're here. And I think that's what I really love about it, is you can really feel that reciprocal relationship and how you're remembering all of these things are coming up out of the soil through you, and then they come out into this book. And it's almost like that feeds back down, and there's this constant up and down and up and down, and like this spiral weaving between you and your garden. I think that's such a strong image that I really took from it, was this idea of the welcoming and the gratitude that you both have for each other.
Yes, and that was such a profound realization from spending time in the space, actually, that, you know, tending the garden was much more than, you know, planting some things and trying to harvest some things and admiring some pretty flowers. That actually there was this real sense of that my being in the garden really mattered to the garden, actually. And that my interventions, even though they might be clumsy and inexpert, and obviously I get things wrong, you know, some people have been really kind and kind of talking to me about the book and have been like, well, obviously you're this amazing gardener. And I'm like, that's not the point, not really. But what I have really tried to do, I suppose, is listen to the space. And I one of the things that really struck me while writing the book, and I suppose I have written that into the book, was how being with the garden and trying to get to know this place and trying to understand what it wanted in order to thrive and be a beautiful space, I realized that I was listening in the way that I had to listen as a therapist, you know, that actually there's so.
I was going to ask if that had played any part in you writing the book.
Absolutely. Because when we're in a room with a patient, of course you listen to the words that people say, but we know that our verbal communication is a tiny fraction. I think, you know, research says 7%, you know, like that's a tiny fraction of how of all that we communicate between one another as humans. So there's so much that we understand that comes from the non-verbal realm. And of course, the garden is a non-verbal realm, but that's, 93% of the way in which I understand the world is in the non-verbal realm. So I sort of started realizing that actually I could listen to this space in the same kind of way that I could listen in the therapy room, if I quieted myself and made myself still and was just spent time in it. And so a lot of my gardening looks really lazy to the outsider, because a lot of it is just kind of sitting around staring into space. If you're kind of looking at me when I'm gardening. But a lot, yeah, so a lot of that was listening, a kind of deep listening to the space, and getting a just kind of getting a sense of what it felt like the space wanted. And it was a garden that had been loved. The people who had lived here before had done a huge amount of work kind of carving this beautiful hard landscaping out of this difficult site. It's really steeply sloping, it's heavy clay. It used to be field. It's they did a massive amount of work, but there was a lot of structure in place in terms of hard landscaping, but there wasn't a lot of flowers. There weren't a lot of plants. There was a lot of bare earth. And so trying to understand what that soil needed, what that earth needed, what this space that felt a little bit desolate needed, involved a lot of listening. And I realized that I could listen to it actually, that I could, if I tuned in a particular way, I could hear it. And then I really started to see the bounty that the garden then yielded as its response to that, as a kind of, a grateful abundance. And one of the things that's really moved me over the years that we've lived here is the increase in insect life in the garden. I mean, there are just clouds and clouds of them. At the minute, we have so many butterflies. Like, it's beautiful. And it does feel in response to the things that we've done, to kind of make the garden more welcoming and inviting and feel more of a home for them, as well as a home for us. So there is this real sense of reciprocity, actually. And I remember reading about it first, actually, in Robin Wall Kimmerer's beautiful book, Great Grass. I'm talking about the relationship with sweet grass, actually. That actually if that the plant thrived when humans harvested it in the kind of traditional ways, that actually the plant needed that, it wanted that, and it was grateful for that interaction with human hands. And we've evolved with these spaces over millennia, so of course they're happy to have us in them. And this idea, and I've you kind of meet it in the idea of rewilding, don't you? That we have to absent ourselves from natural spaces, and that we somehow spoil them. And if we protect the space from humans, then the space will rewild and it will all be magically better. And I don't think that's true. I think human hands and feet have touched the soil. We're such a curious, exploratory, interactive species. I think the whole planet has been a garden, really, for a long time, and really thrives if we, when we are in contact with the other beings around us. I think we're vital to the ecosystem. Well, we can see how vital we are to the ecosystem through the climate crisis, through the fact that we're the negative impact that we're having through our the current relationship that we have with the soil. So our relationship with our gardens, with the soil around us, with whatever land that we are in contact with, is really, really vital. And I think it's more about thinking about what kind of relationship it is that we have, rather than absenting ourselves from this. I mean, absenting ourselves from this space is having a relationship with it, but it's one that's distant and neglectful in itself, and not necessarily one that's loving and reciprocal. There's a loving and reciprocal relationship with place that is possible for all of us, and I think place is kind of longing for us to come back into loving and reciprocal relationship with it.
And I feel like there's such a great
There's such great potential for hope in that as well, because when, like you were saying, you know, the butterflies are all coming back, and that it feels so, because I've got a little patch where the vegetables are, and then it's not big at all. And then half of it I kind of just let go because I just kind of wanted to see what came up. And really nothing much other than bramble has come up, to be honest. But I planted some verbena, and the purple flowers came out. And then a couple of weeks ago, they were literally just covered in butterflies. And that just felt so rewarding. It's like, I did that. I put those plants out there, and now the garden's got, you know, when I look at, we've got like a goat willow, and you know, just other little sort of trees and shrubs kind of along the border, and again covered in bees. And there is, it's such a source of hope. You look at your little patch of land and you go, I did that. I brought that back to life. And if, you know, it's about like widening that out so that it's, you know, because I think, I mean, I don't know, the news this week has just been harrowing. I don't know how you felt, but I know there has been a real sense of like, oh my God, what are we doing? What have we done? But I think we're so focused on the awful things that we've done because we see what's around us and we see what is continuing to happen, that often we forget, like you say, about the amazing things that we've done, the really deep relationship we've had with the land for, like you say, millennia. It's so easy to forget that and to think we are just a curse on the land.
I mean, I think it does feel like our ruling class is trying hard to be a curse on the land at the minute. And I think that is something that has been a theme for the last few hundred years, actually. And that there needs to be some kind of rising up against that. There really does. And what form that takes, I have no idea. I don't pretend to have any kind of answers to that. But I sort of feel as though each of us needs to find our own way, sort of individually and collectively. But how do we begin that? And every time I think about it, the only way I can think of a beginning that feels real and true to me is to try and find some kind of loving reciprocal relationship with a bit of land that you can have access to. Find a patch of land and love it and feel what that does to the land and feel how the land seems to love you back, like you're experiencing with your garden. And that, I think, will feed us and will fuel us and will provide the collective energy to bring about the change that we need. I sort of the book in a way goes in an arc from Death Instinct to Libido. And I started off putting that stuff much more explicitly in the book, and then in the end I was like, this is a lot of psychoanalytic jargon that probably doesn't make a lot of it won't really make sense to the reader in that form. So I stripped it out in its explicit form, but it's still very much there in the kind of underlying backbone of the book. And so the book ends on libido being love, but really libido, the definition of it being the kind of generative, creative life force that drives survival, that drives our thriving. That makes us do anything good and creative and new. And I think nurturing that and finding our way back into contact with that will drive a collective shift into something creative and generative and new. That I feel I just and I I don't know what that will look like. I can't know what that will look like, and it'll probably look very different in different places according to different communities' needs. But that is the energy that I think that we all need to try and find and nurture and tap into and allow to expand and nourish and kind of drive our lives forward. And I think a lot of the energy that we have been living in, that we've been trapped in, is a sort of death instinct, a kind of death because this whole thing about allowing the leaders that we have to carry on making the decisions that they're making on our behalf, it feels pretty suicidal as a species. And so I do see it as a kind as a form of madness, and I do see it as though in the things that have happened over the last few hundred years that have traumatically separated a lot of people from the land. And I see that as having happened, obviously, where I grew up in Trinidad, with the native people of Trinidad, where being kind of, the genocide that happened when the colonizers arrived. My other ancestors who kind of stripped from their land on the African continent and shipped over to Trinidad and so on. But it's also happened here, the Enclosures Acts, the kind of native people of this land were stripped from relationship with their land. And there's been such a forgetting of that here, actually. And I feel really sad for the people of this land, more so actually than I do for Trinidad, because I feel like at least we have some knowing of that. We have some knowledge of that kind of traumatic relationship that happened that we're having to kind of reckon with and forever, constantly try to negotiate our way to something more healthy. But I feel like here, there's such a profound denial of that. It feels actually as though here are a few steps behind, because we need to do the work of acknowledging the fact that that has even happened to then begin to repair that relationship. That to me, that feels where hope lies, and hope does involve navigating pain. I feel like there's this idea that hope is some kind of Pollyanna-ish, optimistic, it'll all be fine in the end. And that doesn't feel like true hope to me, actually. That feels like just another form of denial, and that you won't ever get at anything kind of real and true and new if you stay in that position. And one of the things that again feels really important to me as a therapist is the importance of pain. Pain like really vital signal from our bodies that we have been socialized to think of pain as just being bad. And of course it's horrible to be in chronic pain. I'm not trying to dismiss the idea of pain and of living with pain. But we have this kind of social idea of it as being just this horrible thing that you have to just annihilate. You take the painkillers and you get rid of it and you try to obliterate it as soon as possible. Whereas actually, it's this vital signal from our bodies, from our beings, about something that's not working well, about something that needs our attention, that we have to turn towards and tend to. It's the same with these things that are emotionally painful. They are signals, they are vital alarm signals of things that we really need to turn towards and tend to and attend. And we try and deny and dampen down and suppress and ignore pain. We can't do that in isolation. We end up doing that to all of our feelings at the same time. And actually, we then end up dampening down our capacity to love and to feel joy and to feel bliss and transcendence and awe and all these wonderful things that I think are going to be the things that will save us. They're the things that will bring about these kind of loving reciprocal relationships that we need. So I do think we need to find ways of coming together so that we can bear the pain and feel it and work through it. And there's so much joy waiting for us in that.
And I feel like so many people respond to pain with anger, and that's what I've noticed, certainly in this country, when it comes to having these conversations, is people will respond with feeling like they're being attacked, and that's where the conversations get shut down, because people just shout back. And it's like, but this isn't a discussion. You're shutting me down because I'm raising something that feels like you're the one that's being accused of something, where we're just trying to move the conversation on.
Yeah, and that's a really common response actually. Anger is a kind of what we think of as a secondary emotional response, and it's really protecting against something that's much more vulnerable underneath, which would be the pain of coming into contact with loss, really. I think if you really kind of sat down and looked truthfully at this green pleasant land, we have to face the pain of loss of the fact that we're one of the most nature deprived countries in Europe. We have to face the pain of the loss that this kind of mythic rural idyll that we hold in our collective imagination of what is a pure good rural England is actually a really damaged landscape. You know, the image that we have is something post conquest.
Yes, yeah.
And that's the one that we have held on to as something that's the pure and good and the real kind of true beautiful England. And so we have to face the pain of that not being true, really.
Yes.
And having to realign all of our perspectives of, well, what does it mean then to live in this land and to love this land? You know, I think I love England, but actually the way that I've been loving it has become perverse over all of these years. And actually, I'm hating the land in the way that I respond to it. You know, I think that's why gardening and the kind of gardening establishment has reacted, as you say, with some interesting anger.
Yeah.
Even in the latest Chelsea Flower Show, there's been some really interesting press around the idea of rewilding and things, and some very interesting reactions from prominent gardening people that feel very angry. And I think it's that, you know, like I've been gardening for such a long time in a way that I think is really loving.
Yeah.
But actually, perhaps what I've been doing is incredibly controlling. Perhaps what I've been doing is actually detrimental in a way to the land that I think that I've been looking after in this very loving way. And I need to learn a new way to love the land. But if I'm going to open myself up to doing that, I have to face the vulnerability of the grief that perhaps I wasn't loving the land in a nurturing and wonderful way all this time. So I think that's what the anger tends to come from. It's a protective defense mechanism to avoid having to sit with the pain of loss, the pain of grief. And the, you know, mourning is a really interesting thing, and I do write about it towards the end of the book, because it's a concept that I think is really important. It's actually a really vital part of our emotional development, you know, in infancy, learning, you know, kind of learning how to mourn, because what it does is it allows us to bring good and bad parts of an experience together and hold them together in all of their nuanced complexity. And, you know, to realize that you can love something that is troubled, or that you know, that you yourself might have harmed something, but actually you can still love it. You can still love it as well. And it allows us to then form a relationship that's more kind of healthy with these objects that we love, with these things that we love. And there are times when I look at the kind of this society, I mean English society in particular, and you know, I can't speak for the world at large, obviously, and I really feel like we need some kind of mourning process. You know, even just in relation to the most recent crisis that we've been through, COVID, you know.
Yeah.
I think that we need, that would be a, you know, collective rituals of mourning, I think, would be so helpful to us, help us navigate some of these feelings that otherwise we just don't know what to do with, you know. And then they end up being expressed in all sorts of other ways that don't move us forward. We end up being stuck with them.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the things I was thinking when I sort of, especially when I was finishing the book, it feels like the last couple of chapters, the Salvia and Viburnum, have I said that right? Viburnum 2?
Yes.
There is this real sense of, like you say about mourning, and I thought of it in terms of like catharsis and that purging of, because I wondered, I mean, though for me, those two chapters are, I mean, the book is deep and complex and profound, but for me, those last two really kind of draw that out and bring it through and bring it all together. And I wondered about whether there was that pain as you wrote the book and whether that kind of came out, and maybe pain is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, that kind of purging of like the way that you're connecting with not just your land but your heritage, your ancestors, and then that connection, that lovely part where you realize is it your aunt, like your, what, your,
my cousin,
woman who was
researching our family,
yeah, history. when you, yeah, go down a bit further and you're just like thrilled that, you know, the connection to Trinidad is so much deeper than you thought. And yeah, but I was wondering about the process of, yeah, that purging and the kind of emotional, I guess, response to writing the book as you went on.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it was a cathartic experience necessarily. I mean, it was painful, because to write truthfully about the emotional experience and to help the reader come into contact with something truthful,
mm-hmm,
I had to allow myself to come into contact with the truth of the emotions that I wanted to explore and, mm-hmm, write about. And so, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of sobbing in front of laptops as I navigated certain parts of the book, because I had to feel truthfully certain things in order to then kind of pass out what I wanted to offer to the reader and the emotional experience that I wanted the reader to have,
mm-hmm,
as they journeyed through the book. So yes, there was a lot of coming into contact with a degree of pain, actually. And I would really love my next book to be all about joy so that I don't have to go through that again, but we'll see. But I wanted that pain to have meaning, mm-hmm, you know, in exactly the same way that I think of pain as this like important signal for us to attend to and to turn towards. I tried very hard in my writing to do that with the bits of the book that were more painful, you know, to kind of make them, to write them in a way that actually, you hopefully, the reader leans into them and can allow themselves to feel, to come into contact perhaps with something that is a bit more painful, but in a way that is bearable.
Mm-hmm.
And to then be able to move through that, because that, you know, that's the thing about feelings. We don't, you know, the word emotion is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
they are in motion. And when we avoid and repress and use all of our defense mechanisms to avoid dealing with more painful, more traumatic things about our past, whether that's individual or collective, all that happens is that they get stuck, and that we, mm-hmm, end up stuck in these cycles where we're compelled to keep repeating the same kind of painful mistakes over and over and over again. So I really wanted to bring the reader, and you used the word spiral earlier on, which really pleased me, because I was thinking about the image of a spiral all the time that I was writing this book, you know, that I wanted the reader to be able to spiral through something more difficult, but emerge from that into something beyond that. And, you know, I don't know what that will feel like for each person reading the book, you know, and I very much hope that each person reading the book has their own experience. You know, I hope that it brings something out for them that's very kind of personal to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much a hope of mine. But I do hope that it brings them through and into something new. And whether that feels cathartic for them, I don't know. You know, whether that feels healing or helpful, whether that feels like a type of mourning, you know, I don't know what it will feel like for the reader. But yes, I did have to let myself go through some of the experiences that I write about in order to bring an emotional truthfulness to my writing. Yeah. So it was a bit of a process writing this book.
But I think what it's led to is this, like you said, it is deeply honest. And I think there'll be a lot of people that see themselves in this book, I would imagine. And for me, it was this, the joy of the connection with your garden and how that links to absolutely everything that you are. And it really, I think it's one, because it's easy to write about a garden and then have it just be about, like you say, pretty things. But actually, I certainly appreciate the fact that you had to go to those places to create this book. I understand. I can see how that could have been, those difficult places to go to. But I think, the fact that it's already award winning speaks volumes, really. And I think the fact that it's had so many good, amazing reviews so far, just, I feel like this is the book I've been wanting to read for ages,
Oh,
you know?
thank you.
And I know I sound really gushy, but I enjoyed it, and I think I'll probably read it again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, it's really interesting. When I was writing it, I had this sort of hope in my mind that felt a little bit mad. But what I really wanted to do was to write something that connected my unconscious with the reader's unconscious.
Yes.
I wanted to go beyond the conscious message of what you kind of take from the actual words on the page and to provide something of that non-verbal communication. I really want that to come across in the experience of reading the book, so that something would touch the reader in a deeper way than I could convey that by kind of stringing a few words together. So to hear you say that feels really moving, because it feels very much like what I was hoping to achieve with the writing. So I feel really moved to hear you say that. Thank you.
So I'm really conscious of time. I've got two more questions, which I ask everyone, and they're slightly different to the two questions I used to ask everyone, so I changed them slightly. So the first one is, what advice would you give to your younger self in terms of your creativity?
Oh man, I would tell her to hold on to it. I mean, I suppose I didn't. I suppose I did. I suppose I did, actually. I mean, it's so funny how this book feels full circle in lots of ways, where I can remember vividly being at a cross section when I was 16, when I was choosing A level subjects, and I really wanted to do languages and literature, as well as like biology and chemistry, which just felt like to the adults advising me, like a mad combination, and not a very one that would not necessarily provide me with a secure future. And so I was advised very lovingly to focus on the sciences. That would be where a more secure career path would lie, rather than the world of the arts, which is a bit more insecure. I think it's fair to say now that I am in the world of the arts. They weren't wrong. But so in lots of ways, I feel as though I have circled back to where I was at that point, when I was wanting to tell stories and explore stories. And I mean, I have been doing that. It feels as my journey through being a therapist has always been about story. It's always been about understanding stories, and trying to make sense of story and trying to listen to the stories that haven't been told, bring them to light. But I've finally arrived at a point where I felt as though I could tell my own story. Which is where I was all those years ago, wanting to tell a story, but not really believing that anyone would, not having the faith in myself that I could. And maybe actually at that age I couldn't. But I would tell my younger self to keep the faith that I am, But I am creative, actually. And that being interested in science doesn't mean that you're not creative. You know, it's a weird binary that we've, I mean, science is deeply creative. You know, to be a good scientist, you've got to be deeply, deeply creative and curious and, you know, and have all the things that allow you to generate wonderful new ideas. So yeah, I think I tell her to keep the faith and to believe that actually she is a creative being.
I love that. And then the last question, and actually that's advice I give to my younger self as well. So yeah, the last one is, what are you looking forward to? Might be an obvious question given that today's publication day, but it might not be. There might be something else.
Oh man. Well, in the immediate term, yeah, I'm looking forward to like having a drink and raising a glass to my book and just like, oh, I hadn't realized quite how much tension I was holding on to actually in the run up to today. And this morning, it does feel like a beautiful exhale, like a wonderful out breath, you know. The book is out in the world and I've done my bit and now may she go well. No, it does in the immediate term, that is what I'm looking forward to. I suppose in the slightly longer term, I am looking forward to meeting people who've read it and hearing what people think about it, actually. And I feel really lucky in that I do have quite a fair number of events lined up, so I will be able to kind of meet people and actually chat to people and have those conversations and those connections. Because you know, the book, in a way, the book was born out of that. You know, a lot of my initial writing was on social media, was on Instagram, my newsletter, you know, so there were a lot of conversations and connections that kind of at the very inception of it. And so it feels beautiful to be able to come full circle again and have conversations and connections with people and hear what the book brings up for them and ways that it might have resonated with them or not, you know, have my own ideas challenged. I'm looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to that bit. Yeah.
I love that. And I know, yeah, because obviously I saw you, we got to meet in the flesh at Brighton Book Festival. And that was so, I mean, if that's the kind of thing that you're doing before the book's even out, I think now that the book is out and you're in front of people who have read the book, I think it's, I hope that it's a even more enriching and fulfilling experience for you.
Yeah, I think it will be. I think
Yeah.
it will be pretty wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so before we say goodbye, how can people get the book? Where can they find you? Have you got like a list of events that you're doing or?
Yes, I do. So quite possibly the best place to find, I mean, almost always the best place to find me is sadly on social media. Far too much time. Instagram is my sort of natural home. I am Afroliage, a little pun on having an afro and foliage on Instagram. I also have a website, which is just my name, marshallfarrell.com, and I do try very hard to keep the list of events updated there. And I also have links there to and on Instagram to places where people can order the book. But essentially, it should be available from any good bookshop. I say, please, 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 please support your local independent bookstore. And if they don't actually have it in, just ask them to order it for you, and they should be able to do that really easily. And if the cost of the hardback is impossible, because wow, we books. Expensive
Yeah,
nowadays.
they really are.
I'm a librarian's daughter,
Yeah.
so please borrow it from your local library because
Oh, we
nothing
love
would
the
bring
library.
me more joy than that as well. So yes, that's how people can get hold of the books, and that's where they can find me if they would like to follow on this journey of wherever the garden and these words of mine take me next.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Marshall. This has just been so lovely. It's so lovely to catch up properly and to see everything that you are in a book. And I know that there's going to be so much more from you, and I'm really excited to see what this brings in the future.
Oh, thank you so much, Helen. It is always a joy to speak with you. So thank you so much for giving me this time this morning.